I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to episode 124 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my live streaming career as a radio presenter with one big regret, never getting to interview my hero, the legendary British musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. On this episode of the podcast, I am joined by lead singer and songwriter for the multi-platinum selling band Ocean Colour Scene. Just days away from the release of his book, One for the Road, created with his lifelong friend, award-winning author and former podcast guest, Daniel Rachel, I feel like Simon needs no introduction really, but just in case you've been living on the moon, this band have been huge over the past 30 years. Massive hits like The Riverboat Song, The Circle, The Day We Caught the Train, 100 Mile High City, and so much more. A band with so many links to Paul Weller too, supporting each other on live shows and before performing on each other's records. Let's get into it. And this one on location with Simon Fowler. Hey, Simon, thanks for joining me.
That's a pleasure, mate.
Now, when I had your best friend, Daniel Rachel, on the podcast, I mentioned you and I called you Foxy Fowler, and he burst into hysterics because he was like, that's what his old man's called. That's his dad's name.
But, that's right, yeah.
But I thought Foxy Fowler was the nickname, was what people knew you as.
Right? It's always, Oscar and Steve don't really call me anything. They never really call me Simon.
They just call you Foxy.
Yeah, and also, I mean, and so did Paul. Paul Weller started calling me Foxy as well. And he used to, when I used to play with Paul, you know, and appear with his band. So I was always introduced as Foxy. It's Foxy Fowler, yeah. So all of Paul's crowd, I'm basically Aunt Foxy, which is kind of quite nice, really, because I think my dad always wanted to be on the stage. So he ended up as a policeman instead. But I think that I get my love of singing from him. He's got a very, very nice tenor. Mine's a fiver to his tenor, I'd say.
But where does the love of writing come from? Because obviously, you know, as much as a brilliant singer you are, the songwriting and a real gift for lyricism is something that you've got. At one point, you wanted to be or were a journalist. Was that right?
Yeah, I was a journalist, yeah. I wanted to be a football commentator. That's why I became a journalist. I wanted to be John Motson. Actually, I've just been reading an article by John Motson about Ronnie Radcliffe's goal in the FA Cup in the early 70s. That's what I wanted to be. But within 2 weeks of working in a newspaper office, I realised I didn't really like being told what to do by short, balding men who were infinitely better at their jobs than I was ever going to be. And clock watching, I just thought, now listen to me, I don't want to be John Motson anymore. I want to be John Lennon. Do you want to mean? I always kind of wanted to be in a band and a singer, but it just seemed to dream too far, I think. Mm.
And was it, were you able to play an instrument from a young age?
Yeah. I got my first guitar when I was 9. And I always used to entertain the family at Christmases, you know, coming around the mountain, should we come around the mountain, Red River Valley, Beatles, Simon and Garfunkel songs. And then I kind of got into Neil Young, and that sort of changed my life, really.
Now, we're on the eve of the release of this very special limited edition book, One for the Road, The Lives and Lyrics of Simon Fowler and Ocean Colour Scene. And it's as much about your life as a singer-songwriter and these songs that have had such an impact on so many of our lives and continue to do so, as it demonstrates your life in this band for, what, over 30 years now, right?
What's the date? It's 33 years. 33 years in October it was, yeah. We get parole next year.
What keeps that spark? What keeps that fire in your belly to want to keep doing this?
I can't really do much else. It's what we do. It's our life's work, isn't it, I guess, really? I'll settle for that one.
It's not a bad life, is it, to be fair? Yeah. Now, this is the Paul Weller Fan Podcast, so we're digging into some of these memories, and we'll talk about the songs that you've covered in the book and how you selected those. And some of them do relate to Mr. Weller, which will be lovely to dig into. But am I right in thinking you were born on Paul Weller's birthday?
Yes. He's exactly 7 years older than me. Yeah.
And have you ever celebrated your birthday together?
I don't know, to be honest. I can't remember doing so. Probably a good job we haven't, really. That would have sounds a bit messy to me. In my family, though, I was actually born on my grandmother's birthday. So, but yeah, Paul's 25th of May. And I'm sure that, this is another weird one. His mother's maiden name is Craddock.
Oh, right. Yeah. That is weird.
Dude, the stars were aligned.
Now, Paul and the Jam are mentioned quite a bit in the book, I gather. Weller's music, before you met him, before you were mates and all that, it meant a lot to you as well, did it? Or was it just Steve who was really into the Jam? Were you a fan as well?
It meant everything to Steve. I liked the Jam, but I always thought that they were probably... at my school, I seem to remember that by the time we were sort of fourth and fifth year, there was the Jam, there was Blondie, well, Debbie Harry, mainly, really, for obvious reasons, popular with the fourth form boys, probably the Police, and then the two-tone stuff. And then there was the people who ended up in the computer room, the one computer room, the Dungeons and Dragons fans, who were all into heavy rock. Spots, greasy hair, and no girlfriends. It was the one computer room, isn't that hilarious thought now?
And it was really early on in the this lifespan of the band that you met Paul. So it was like 89, really early days that you met up with Mr. Weller for the first time. Is that right? And he was a fan of Sway, that first.
It was 89, yeah. Crikey, I was going to say it's 93. No, it was 89. We recorded the first album initially down at Solid Bond with Jimmy Miller. Brendan was there. Brendan and Max were there at the time, who became the star guy. I'm sure they were there. Yes, I'm sure that they were there because Brendan was doing, at the same time as working with Paul, he was working on the Young Disciples' Roads to Freedom. Because that front cover is in Hyde Park, which is just directly in front of Solid Bond. So Brendan was working on that. And yeah, we all became a sort of a gang, and Steve and Paul became very close, and Steve joined Paul's band in 93. Been with Paul for 30 years.
I know, that's mad.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, I'd love to understand a bit about this, because as we get through this story, because obviously there's a point where he's double shifting. Part of Ocean Colour Scene's in your band, but then you're having to share him and Damon, actually, at that point.
Right, yeah.
With Paul. Was there a bit where you were kind of like, hold on, these are my guys?
No, it wasn't. Paul always used to imagine that I had that opinion of him. But in all honesty, we were chuffed. We were flattered. And also, we thought it couldn't do anything but good for us. We were sort of like, some of that magic was just falling on our shoulders as well. It wasn't just dandruff. Yeah, falling our magic like dandruff it was. So, it was sort of a bit of reflected glory, and I didn't see anything wrong with that. I mean, we were all part of the same gang. And we introduced Paul to Noel. So there was Paul, us, the Gallaghers, and the verse is the Britpop lot.
The first time I saw you was in 1992, and it was my first Paul Weller gig. So I discovered Mr. Weller through the solo career. I went to Paul Arts Centre, and it was around the time your first LP would have been out, Ocean Colour Scene, that first album. You guys were supporting Paul, so I got double whammy. I got Ocean Colour Scene, then Weller, it's my first proper gig of just me and my mates,
Right.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Loved it.
Yeah.
And then it was so interesting then to follow Paul, because there were so many connections with you throughout that journey and your band throughout that journey as well. And I wanted to talk about Wildwood, because this was recorded down at the Manor in Oxford, this beautiful residential studio, April, May 1993. And people who have been on the podcast, people like Jack O'Peake, Max Beasley, Helen Turner, Dr. Robert, all these amazing characters, Steve White and so on.
Goodness gracious, we had to name for the past. Helen was far more refined than everybody else, wasn't she? It was really extraordinary that she was in Paul's band. I think everyone thought of her, she was a bit like a school teacher. I think everyone was slightly frightened of her. Helen and Yolanda as well.
They probably kept you in check, you lot, because it sounds like you were just passing all the time, right?
That's pretty much true, yeah. Paul actually had to pick me up off the floor, basically, when he said, are you doing a Weaver? Because I don't read, I was going to do the Weaver with you, the backing vocals. Well, it was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and there was him. So I started whimpering away, and suddenly this great sort of bleeding Curtis Mayfield voice comes in at the side of me, and it's Paul. I'm thinking, what the hell am I doing on this?
But a really happy, positive time, clearly.
Though. Yeah, it was hung up on that album.
It was on the reissue, so when they reissued Wildwood,
because I was in the video on that one. That was another party day. That was because that was recorded at the Manor. The hung up video. That was that evening I met Noel for the first time at a hotel in Oxford. He said, oh, we're coming down, we're playing at a place called the Jug of Ale in Moseley. I said, oh, blimey, that's our HQ. We'll come along and see. And they were supporting a band called Whiteout. They were doing one of those, well, the ones they support one night and then they change over the following night. And that's how I got to know that lot. And I remember meeting Liam there, and I'd never met anyone like him in my life, and I still haven't.
Am I right in thinking you introduced Noel to Paul?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much so, yeah. And then, you see, within a few weeks, they'd become like tight pals. And so Noel had suddenly exchanged his size 6 trainers for size 6 loafers, which, much to Liam's chagrin. So Liam used to call him, hey, wella fella. And the irony was, of course, is that years later, it would be Liam opening the clothes company called Pretty Green.
Yes.
Wella fella.
Wonderful. Brilliant. Well, look, we'll dig into some more of those memories in a sec, but let's talk about the book, because you created with, you know, I mentioned your best mate, Daniel Rachel, and he talks about the time when you were flatmates. So it was you, him, and Steve in Birmingham, right?
That's right, yeah. For ages, yeah. Daniel had got a band as well called Rachel's Basement. He was trying to get off the ground. So Daniel was there at the off, really, and sort of watched it all happen. But I've known Daniel since he was 5. Our parents lived 2 or 3 doors from each other on the Warwick Road in Alton. My dad used to take their family to school in the car and, you know, used to mend their bicycle punctures. And we grew up like that. I'm 4 years older than that. Dan also was the guy who introduced me to Damon. Daniel actually was at, what's he called, junior school with Steve. And then he was at Tudor Grange, which is school I went to, with Damon Minchella and with Robert Hayes. And Robert is my partner, who I've been with for longer than the band. I've been with Rob for longer than I've been with the band. And so without Daniel, I wouldn't have been in Ocean Killer Scene, and I wouldn't have met Robert. So I'd have probably been happily married with 5 children editing Match of the Day. So Daniel ruined my life.
I would imagine. I mean, he's a hugely successful author and has written some amazing books over the past few years. And
yeah, he's doing well, isn't he? He's doing well. He stopped trying to be a pop star and became a writer, and he's done a real nice niche for himself. His books are really beautifully done, yeah.
Yeah, amazing. But I would imagine he's been on at you for a while about doing a book with you, isn't he?
No, he wasn't. It was my idea, really. We were initially thinking about possibly reissuing a lyric book that we did about 10 or so years ago. And that just suddenly struck me. And I guess that the catalyst was getting Macca's book. And we basically, we've done it in a similar format, which is where you take a song and you hang that chapter on that song. And then from discussing the genesis of the song, along come the stories, especially when we used to end up down here. I'm at my local at the moment. And Daniel and I used to do 2 or 3 hours in my house in the morning. Then we'd have lunch, and then we'd come down here to the pub, and that's probably when I told the better stories. You know what I mean? But yeah, so the Macca book. But the other one that I that worked for me was Craig Brown's book called 1, 2, 3, 4, about the Beatles. And again, what it does, it puts into, I think it's 99 chapters. Like each chapter is like 3 or 4 pages long. So the way that I did it was read a chapter a morning. And then I'd have stories to bore all of my pub friends with. And then the following day, I'd have another one to bore them with. And he also did the same thing called Darling Mum, about Princess Margaret. So again, it was fragments, and it builds up. It's a really nice way of reading a book, because you can go in and out of it. And so that's what the format struck me as. And I couldn't have done it with anybody else, really. because Daniel and I almost speak in shorthand, you know, to each other.
And so much of the books that he writes kind of comes through those conversations. It's a really lovely way of doing it. You know, yeah. You get those kind of honest.
I think the book is also, I mean, it's about my band and my lyrics and me, but it's also very much about me and the members of the band, but also me and Daniel. And I hope that comes over, that it sort of started to take on that a life of its own in a way, that we realized that what we were doing was really writing a book about a bromance, you know.
It's like a love story in a way.
Yeah. And that sort of, it just took on its own momentum, that did. But let's face it, no one really wants to be analysing verse 3, line 4, who they are, men of such opinion.
I was about to ask you about that one, damn. When you look back at all this work, though...
Do you look like Rory Bremner?
Do I?
Yeah, you do, yeah.
Well, is it an impression of Boris Johnson, or... It's the hair.
It's the hair.
Yeah. When you look back at these lyrics and the work that you've created there, did you have to kind of re-listen to the songs? Because some of them you're not performing live, probably you haven't performed live for quite a while.
No, Daniel chose them.
Oh, okay.
He chose all of them and he came as a fait accompli, really. And I just said, well, listen, whatever you've chosen, I'll go along with it. Because let's face it, we could have spent hours. It's hard enough to do a bleeding set list, yeah, alone 69 songs. I don't know why it was 69, but I don't know if there's some sort of there, Daniel.
The comedy element.
If it is, Daniel wouldn't understand it. Honestly, he is very wet behind the ears and he is the worst drinker probably in Britain. Because I'm the best.
So when you look at these lyrics and let's talk about you as a lyricist. How do you go about it? Do you have a kind of set formula where your guitar and pads?
Yeah, I just sit with I can only play the acoustic guitar, with an old fashioned tape player, you know, a cassette player, the type you get for Christmas in 1972. We got one of them. It was a shared Christmas present, Nick and I, my older brother. And I used to do impressions of Frank Spencer into it and, you know, things like that. He was my hero before John Motts. So that's how I still write. It's very difficult, actually, to get hold of cassettes.
Do you still use the cassette? Although they're coming back, I saw like things are being released.
I always have them. See, it's so quick, it's so instant. And I basically mumble, half sing, half some words, a bit of mumbling. Then I listen back to that. And, you know, you get sort of like bits here, then at number 033, there's a bit that could be that part. And eventually you put it together. And then I take really the rhythm of the lyrics come from my mumblings. So that becomes, is it called the syntax? Is based on, my lyrics are based around the rhythm that I've created with my mumblings, really. Not all the time. Sometimes lyrics come like from outer space, but that's the way that I do it. So I've got the bare bones of it with the melody.
And some of them come easier than others. Some of them, there's songs that are like really hard work to get there, but it was worth it.
Those are usually the least successful songs. The Circle, for instance, came to me incredibly quickly, almost as it is. And then you think, well, how did I do that? And I thought, I don't know. You just do it. That's how you do it. You'd sit down and you do it. And it either comes or it doesn't.
Right.
But if I hadn't sat down, nothing would have come.
Yes, I suppose. Yeah, it's the thing of actually pen to paper getting and doing it, isn't it? You know, without that, you're not going to get anywhere. No. And that was the song Paul covered, actually, on the Gary Crowley GLR show, wasn't he? And he's on that as well.
Gary's show.
Yeah, it was Gary Crowley's show.
I was really proud of that. Like, stupidly proud. But no, genuinely, properly proud. Paul Weller's singing one of our songs. This is madness.
There was a time, actually, I wanted to ask you about, which was the recording of the Help album. This was the album that Paul did for War Child. And there was a track they did, which was
Come Together.
Thank you. And it was actually Abbey Road, right? The recording at Abbey Road. And,
it was Studio 2, yeah.
And you were there. So Weller's there, obviously. Noel Gallagher, Craddock, Steve White, Carleen Anderson. I think Paolo Hewitt, Paul's best mate at the time, had actually faxed Paul McCartney to ask if he'd do it. Or like, faxed Paul Weller's letter to ask if he'd come along. He comes along. I think Johnny Depp's there, Kate Moss, if you watch
Johnny
the video.
Johnny Depp was with Kate Moss. I had a fascinating conversation with Johnny Depp. I explained to him the nature of stardom. I was off my face at the time, actually. Paul McCartney actually came up and said, look after yourself, shook my hand. Look after yourself, young man. But Johnny Depp was, he was a bit dressed as a tramp. He's wearing a pair of jeans like Joe Orton. And in the turn-ups of his jeans was dozens of cigarette butts, which he was showing to Kate Moss, who looked on admiringly.
He was saving his own, or he was picking up other people's?
I don't know, but a couple of weeks later, he'd released an album. It was like old blues songs, and one of them was something like Save Your Cigarette Butts. I thought, you big kid. Explaining the nature of stardom to Johnny Depp. Marvellous.
That's brilliant. I mean, there must be a period of that time where you're kind of properly massive in terms of the band Ocean Colour Cinema. I'd love to talk about Chris Evans as well, because as a radio geek, that kind of TFI Friday Radio 1 thing, when it really properly takes off. But I mean, this explosion of Britpop, and there's a discussion of whether Ocean Colour Cinema were on the fringes, and so was Paul maybe, which is, I think, probably a good thing. But it was huge, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it was. And it was exciting. I mean, I think the press loved it. The press loved the fact that they got their own Beatles and Stones. I think that the two bands kind of played off that as well. It did nobody any harm, the lurid headlines, does it? As long as I spell your name right. We always thought that we were pretty much on the periphery of it. Because I mean, I was genuinely thought of us as more of a folk rock band, you know, in all honesty. But you mentioned Evans, and it was Chris, without a shadow of a doubt. Knowing Paul and knowing the Gallaghers was great fun. And it would have probably given us we could have maybe charted for the album. But we went in at number 2 and stayed there for 6 months. And that was almost single-handedly down to Chris. And I became great mates with Chris and still am. And without him, it wouldn't have happened. It's as simple as that.
He was massive as a broadcaster. So everything he touched, whether it was toothbrush, the big breakfast.
Everything he touched turned to ginger.
I think that was it as well, because I had ginger hair and glasses at the time too.
Oh, really? So I told you, Rory Bramby, you're doing Chris Evans impression.
Yeah, but I used to listen on GLR and tape it every week back in the day, and that was before I knew it was ginger. Actually, thinking about it,
it was great fun, Chris. Real good fun.
But you were that very first episode of TFI, but I think actually you were the pilot as well.
We did the pilot, yeah, and that's when he came up to us and said, "Would you mind if we used Riverboat as the walk-on for the guests?" No, go ahead. I asked him actually if he'd give it all up and come on the road with us, because he was quite a hard taskmaster. But I mean, looking back at it, everything was on his shoulders, wasn't it, really? It was his reputation. But he could be quite explosive in the studio. So I said, "I like the way that you can get everyone to do what you want. Do you want to come on, be our road manager?" I had a drink with him afterwards, and we just hit it off. And I used to live near Richmond, and I used to go down to TFI when we weren't on it, you know, to go and hang out with him and Danny Baker, who was an extraordinary guy, extraordinary bloke. God, talk about Chris holding an audience. You should be with Danny Baker. He's an incredible guy. And that was great fun.
You didn't ever get ropes into the Naked Parade at the end of TFI, did you?
No, I didn't, no.
The first gig for me after lockdown, we've obviously been through this horrendous period where, you know, musicians couldn't gig and we couldn't go out and all that. And my first like little gig after lockdown was, I think it was last year, it was the launch of Daniel's Oasis Nebworth book.
Yeah.
With Jill Firmanowski.
That's a beautiful book, isn't it?
It's one of those books you don't really want to touch. I think yours is going to be as well.
It's too beautiful, isn't it? Yeah. It's all too beautiful, as someone once sang. Yeah.
And it was this little book launch, and there was you and Oscar Harrison, and you do these semi-acoustic gigs, just the two of you.
Yeah, we've been doing it for about 20 years, yeah.
And it was, honestly, it was just brilliant, because I don't know whether it was a mixture of things. I think it was that release that we were allowed back.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Out again. We were experiencing live music, and God, how much we missed that during that period. But it was also these songs, and they hit me, and I kind of had that realization that it was kind of like 25 years since I'd first seen them and seen them live and all that. But it was such a very special evening, that. But you must get a real buzz out of performing those songs, just you and Oscar, because it's a completely different environment.
They're closer to how they were written. Because they're as I wrote them. But it was a strange night, that was, because I was going to go out and say something about Brian Travers had died the day before, who was a friend of ours. And I was going to go and mention that. And then 10 minutes before we go in on stage, someone comes in and says, "Charlie Watts has died."
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
And it absolutely knocked me for six. I didn't, bloody hell, just didn't seem right. Didn't seem right. How can Charlie Watts be dead? He's in the Rolling Stones, you know? And so that was a bit weird, that was really. But it was a good night. And Dan and I are going to go and do a few of those sorts of things ourselves. There's one on the 8th of December. Daniel's working out where we're going to do it.
It'll surface somewhere where it's going to be.
Well, let's talk about some of these memorable gigs as well, because performing live still is a real buzz. I can tell that from watching you perform. That's the reaction that you get from the crowd is, you know, on these proper anthems. And I think that comes back to that kind of folk rock thing. Yeah, these songs are songs that just live through people and mean so much to people. You must get a buzz out of performing on those big stages as well as the kind of smaller acoustic gigs, right?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I really like sort of around about 3,500, that sort of capacity. Something like, I never know the names of these places now because they're all called I still call it the Hammersmith Odeon.
Is it not? That's what I would call it.
That's the type of place I like. And there's a similar kind of place up in Manchester. We played a few years just before the lockdown. We played up at Hydra up in Glasgow, so it's 14,000. I think that's too big.
What was the festival? Wasn't it a festival in Spain? Wasn't it Zaragoza? Wasn't it? Was it like 500,000 people?
It was something like 250,000, but it didn't seem like that because it was basically along an area which I don't know, maybe a mile, 2 miles long, and along every sort of 500 yards or whatever, they'd have a screen and a sound system. No, but I mean, obviously, the biggest gig that we played where you can actually see the audience as an audience was Nebworth
with Oasis.
That was only 125.
Only 125,000 people. And am I right in thinking the first time that you headlined the Royal Albert Hall was Noel and Liam and Paul Weller were there and they were supporting
us. Our support acts were Paul Weller, the Gallaghers. I think P.P. Arnold was there. Mick Talbot was there. All of my friends were there. Yeah, it was extraordinary night. I'll always remember that gig.
I want to talk about some of the songs, and actually the first two I'm going to pick aren't actually in the book. And I don't know why Daniel, well, I know why Daniel didn't pick one of them, because the first one I'm going to talk about has a Paul Weller connection, but you didn't write the lyrics.
On the album On the Ley Line, Paul Weller wrote you a song for Dancers Only.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Steve, I guess. I don't think he wrote that song for us, did he? I don't know. I just thought that it was
he hadn't released it anywhere else,
no,
I don't think.
I don't know. Maybe he just rejected it.
It didn't even make a B-side.
Give it to Foxy. Yeah, give it to Foxy. You can fuck it up. Yeah, I don't really know much about that song, to be honest.
I think it ended up developing into a song, into Old Town off 22 Dreams with Graham Coxon eventually. And there was another song, actually. So the other one I wanted to ask you about was from the album Saturday. And I read somewhere that this is a song dedicated to John Weller, to Paul's dad.
That's called Harry Kidnap. Someone touched the arm. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's essentially about his friendship with Steve's dad and Kenny Wheeler, who was Paul's right-hand man for God knows how many years. And they were like the three, well, they thought they were like the Three Musketeers with bus passes.
and a deck of cards, yeah.
And a deck of cards. Oh, that was the essential, yeah, the essential deck of cards. Mm. It's also, I mean, there's obviously a reference to Harry Redknapp, doesn't it? Well, Harry Redknapp reminds me a bit of John, a bit of a geezer. Yeah. And John, if there was a description of the word geezer, John Weller's photograph at the side of it in the dictionary. Yeah.
And also, let's be honest, John Weller would have been equally brilliant in the jungle as Harry Redknapp was on Arnold Celebrity.
Right.
Can you imagine?
Can you imagine that? Yeah.
But John was really supportive of you and the band and you guys as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, they were. It really did become like a family, yeah? Yeah. Well, the thing is, there was that strange synergy where Paul's dad managed him, Steve's dad managed him, and Chris Craddock looked up very much to John as his sort of mentor, I guess. I think Chris would be quite proud to say that himself.
Yeah, that's lovely. Paul Weller's always talking about what's next and the future and stuff. It's been a while since we've had an Ocean Colour Scene album, I think 2013, but I read the other day, you've signed up with Alan McGee. Bless him, who's been on the podcast. Love Alan, amazing. And there will be new material. So you're constantly writing still, are you?
No, I'm not. No, I haven't written for a while. But this is the plan. I've got quite a few lyrics. But I haven't written for my manager here is shouting at me 7 years.
What is it? Just like it's not there. Like you're not passionate about it to get a notebook out. Or
yeah, I guess that must be an element. Yeah, I mean we used to live basically for the band, and now I don't live for the band. I live for my life in the countryside with Robert and my dog Cooper. Yes, and the pub. That's and the news and newspapers. That's my happiest is to be with those creatures, with the times and a pint of Peroni. And that makes me very happy. But no, it is about time that we did it, because I think otherwise we're going to become status quo, aren't we? We're going to become a heritage circuit. And also the fans deserve something else apart from the ones that we've always done. I mean, there's certain songs we're not going to be allowed out of the hall without playing, aren't there? It would be ludicrous not to. Because I'm strongly of the opinion that albums are for bands and gigs are for fans, you know, because without the fans, there'd be no point in doing a gig.
Do you feel that pressure of that legacy in the same way as maybe Paul did with the Jam when he was moving through his career?
Well, no, I mean, I think Paul was very ruthless and a lot of people didn't appreciate it. When he started off in particular and was not playing Going Underground or Down in the Tube Station. What? Down in the Tube Station is one of the greatest songs ever written and he's not playing it live. Disgraceful. Or English Rose or Butterfly Collect, you know, those things that no, I'm going to play my own new songs. And I think that was very brave of him. And he won through particularly around about the time of Wildwood and Stanley Road, which became huge.
Massive,
under their own steam, and then suddenly they became the classics. He's carried on doing it. He's always now. After a while, he did start playing obviously the old songs, but he still is very stubbornly, what's the word I'm looking for, contemporary.
And it's funny, isn't it? Because now it's almost a similar thing whereby people would crucify him if Broken Stones isn't in the set list or Into Tomorrow's in the set list. You know, as much as Tube Station and all that. Yeah. My question was: do you feel that pressure of what's been before? Because I mean, the quality of these songs, my God, like songs. Like Better Day, The Day We Caught the Train, July, 100 Mile High City, Huckleberry Grove, Profit and Peace, for goodness sake, Robin Hood, Traveller's Tune. I mean, goodness me.
I know that whatever I come up with has got to be good.
Yeah, that bar's high, right?
Yeah, it is. And I've got to see if I can do that.
Is that quite daunting? Is that like approaching it and starting, shit, can I do that still?
Well, it always is. But then when you sit down and halfway through the song, you realise, well, I've always been able to do this and I can still ride a bicycle.
When you were talking to Daniel and creating this book, were there songs that you're really proud of? Like, is there a perfect song that you've written from your
book? I think The Circle is probably not far off that for me. Some of the lyrics, Fleeting Mind has got very interesting lyrics. Men of Such Opinion has got interesting lyrics. If some look trite on paper, but then they're not meant to be poems. Mm. I mean, that's what a lot of people said when Dylan won the Nobel Prize, the Nobel Prize, that sometimes they don't look like poetry or literature on the page. Some of them do, but I don't think they're ever meant to. The two things are indivisible, really, the lyrics from the performance, I think. You'd never write down, "Why don't we do it in the road?" as a poem, would you? But when you have Macca singing it, it's one of the greatest poems in the English language, in my book.
Well, what we mentioned comes together earlier on. It's like, I mean, utter nonsense, right? But actually, it's a song. But as a lyricist, because there's so many like handwritten lyrics in this book as well, which is beautiful. To you, as a lyricist, I mean, it sounds daft, but there's a lot of value in the words that you put into them. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but there's care and attention from your point of view about what you say, right?
Yeah, I'm good with words. I'm horrendous with numbers. Hey Rob, I'll phone you back in a bit. I'm just doing a podcast, whatever that is. I think I'm numerically almost dyslexic, much to the chagrin of my manager who's sitting opposite me.
And you're not interested in like technology or any of that?
No. She's infuriated with me most of the time because I simply do not understand money or computers, which is why Debbie's here and we're using her computer. She said she's got to leave in about 10 minutes.
Oh, right. I better carry on.
All right. I couldn't do this. I don't miss it. You know, that's, as I said, that's why I write on a Sony cassette player.
Oh, yeah, but how much nicer was our lives without social media and all that nonsense and email?
I know how to Google. I know how to Google Neil Young, and that's all I need to know, and the odd word that I don't understand in the Times. Which is perspicacious this morning, used on a desert island disc, and I've got to look it up.
What did it mean?
I don't know. Lauren Laverne used it. Perspicacious. But I was going to look it up and try to see, because my pal who I came in with, he's been sitting over, and I was going to try to slip it in as many times as I could into this interview. But I'm not quite.
You'd have seen me frantically typing, trying to work out what it was.
I'd be most perspicacious to do so.
Now, we should say, in terms of the book, there are lots of editions that are available, one of which includes this 7-inch single of a couple of unreleased songs as well. So these were recorded like in the 80s, for goodness sake.
These were recorded in about 1985. I recorded them for Daniel and for his mother, who we were quite close with, and so was Robert. And he kept them all this time, and he played me them. And it's a lesson, really, in sometimes of how not to sing, because my voice goes from David Bowie to Lou Reed to Bob Dylan to Neil Young, all in the space of one line. It's definitely me trying to find my voice.
That's what it's all about, though, right?
Well, that's right, because you do it, because I started doing it because I loved what they did. You know, I said this to someone the other day when I was doing one of these. I said, you wouldn't say that when Sebastian Coe set the world record in the 800 metres, it wasn't like he was ripping off Roger Bannister, was he? See what I mean? He did it because he admired Roger Bannister, perhaps.
Inspired by it.
And found that he was good at running.
That's a great analogy. And one of these, so there's the American Way of Life and I. And I remember, actually, Daniel mentioned I on the podcast before.
Yeah.
Because that turned into something else, right?
Yeah, well, it is. It doesn't turn into, it's got an extra verse to the one that we recorded, but it's Foxy's Folk Face.
Right, there we go. We go back full circle, back to Foxy again.
I wrote that song when I was 16. That was probably one of the first songs that I wrote which would stand up. I started writing when I was about 13, but they were all about drugs, busts and sex, of which neither of I had any experience whatsoever. I don't think it counts on your own, does it? Just when you're 13.
Yeah. That was the only option in my case, man. Now, a couple of questions before you go. I'll leave Debbie to get her laptop back. There's this wonderful story I heard about you and Mr. Weller in a hotel room, and Steve Craddock came in.
Jesus Christ, yes.
Tell me about this. This
in
is
one
nuts.
Where Steve nearly jumped out the window.
Yeah.
Mm. You'll have to read it in the book.
Oh, is it in the book?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Well, he was, we were all very happy that evening, and Steve was bouncing up and down on the bed. I think it was my room, actually, and just leapt. And fortunately, the window, instead of opening out, I don't know if they all do this for this very reason, I just opened in. So he smacked his head on there, crashed down onto, knocked all, smashed all the glasses, and claret all over the shop. And the following morning, we sort of had a bit of a triumvirate and thought, I think we'd better calm down. You know?
And which song does that relate to in the book, then?
I can't remember, to be honest. I don't know.
I think Daniel mentioned to me about the fact that you used to play Steve Craddock songs in the style of the Jam.
I did with one song, yeah, which I thought was The Circle, but Steve and Oscar have both told me independently that it's not The Circle. It was a song called Beautiful Losers, which I can't imagine doing that in the style. I think I was sort of like, because if I did that, then I know that Steve would probably like it, and then we'd have something to do that day. Just as simple as sort of inauspicious as that, really. It was that perspicaciousness that I really enjoyed about the situation.
Well, I would agree if I knew what that meant.
So would I.
Final Paul Weller thing I want to ask you about, The Roundhouse. So this was last year, last Christmas, right? Nearly a year ago, Christ. And Mr. Weller joined you on the stage for a couple of tunes.
It is nearly a year ago, isn't it? Isn't that terrifying?
Where's that time gone?
Oh, God. Oh, my goodness me. That's ludicrous, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, I'm not having that. I'm not having I'm not having the perspicaciousness of it.
How do you get him up there? I mean, presumably it doesn't take an awful lot to twist his arm,
know,
right?
I didn't know he was coming, to be honest. If he probably, Steve, sure, come out and play. Probably something like that, I should imagine. Yeah. And he was most impressed because he was surprised because Paul's wearing monkey boots. I read something about Paul the other day. He's got some new deal with a clothing outlet.
Yeah, Sunspell, yeah.
And he was talking about now that when he goes on stage, he really likes to go on wearing monkey boots because it makes him feel safe.
He gets a bit of bounce. I read the same thing. He gets a bit of bounce in it.
Well, I think that's seriously what he was referring to.
Yeah. Not as much bounce as a Jam shoe, obviously, but, you know.
No. When we first started playing them, he used to actually wear stilettos. Not a lot of people know that.
He used to pop over for dinner when you were all sharing the flat together, didn't he?
I think he was up a few times, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Alison Moyet came once as well.
You recorded on her albums.
Well, Steve played with us before he played with Paul. He used to go out with Alison's manager, who was a girl called Debbie Rawlins, and we were very close with Alison. She was great fun.
Yeah, brilliant.
She is the biggest laugh I've I've ever met. Wonderful, wonderful bird.
Another one who, we don't have enough material from her. She was from my neck of the woods, Basildon. And yeah, she's fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. Yeah.
She was at school with like Depeche Mode and Vince Clarke. Well, extraordinary class.
Imagine that classroom. Yeah. Imagine music class. It'd be brilliant. Hey, look, I have two final questions for you before you go, my friend. This has been so lovely. Thank you so much. And that's very best in luck with the book. I can't wait to get it in my hands. And it's going to be one of those beautiful coffee books that I want to read, but I'll have to have like snooker referee's gloves to open it. It'll be so precious, you know. But I can't wait. Very best of luck with it. I had two final questions for you, right? It's a Paul Weller fan podcast, so you're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Style Council, or Solo. What would you pick?
Well, I'm going to go for I'm real at the butterfly. I'm going to go for Down at the Tube Station.
And is that because of the lyrics as much as the sound of that song?
The lyrics are amazing, but it just the structure of the song. It's a truly immense, and considering I should suspect he was probably about 18 when he wrote that, which I know shouldn't matter because Stevie Wonder did Uptight when he was 15, but it does matter. It does matter that he was 18 because he was that good, you know, and is that good.
And final question. So the purpose of this podcast is to meet amazing people like yourself and hear their careers and the links with Weller and all that, but it's for me to get the interview with Paul Weller that I never managed during my radio career. So I, like Chris Evans, was a radio presenter, obviously not as anywhere nearly as successful, sadly, but I gave up presenting with that one regret. I never got to interview Mr. Weller. Now, you must have some amazing stories about Paul, lots that have to stay on the road. You know, when you're on the road, those stories stay with you and all that, right? And I've not dug into any of those, but if I get to interview with Paul Weller, what should I ask him? Is there anything I should bring up? Anything you think he'd appreciate? Anything I should talk about?
I would be presumptuous or perspicacious enough to know. I mean, I don't see Paul on a very regular basis anymore because he's down in Maid of Vale, isn't he? I think Paul. Yeah. And I'm up near Stratford upon Avon. Steve sees him all the time, you know. I mean, they're sort of best mates, really, I guess. To be honest, Paul always says his motivation has always been music and clothes and that sort of style. But I think that, in honesty, he's probably his motivation is his family. And I think that that's probably what made him finally grow up.
Is that similar for you with your partner? Like, the inspiration comes from like wanting to write something that your partner feels proud of?
No, I don't think so. When I sit down, I don't think I'm going to write about like Ukraine. I just sort of write and hopefully something makes sense.
Well, somewhere there's a pile of cassettes with all these mumblings on that at some point will be a wonderful deluxe box set in the same way we just had that massive Revolver set from the... Yeah. Hey, man, this has been so lovely. Thank you so much for your time.
I've really enjoyed speaking to you. Yeah, thank you very much. And hopefully we'll meet up one day.
Well, yeah, that would be lovely, man. Thank you so much, honestly. Thank you so much for joining me and all the best.
Cheers. And yourself. Goodbye.
Thanks, Simon. Much appreciated.
That's good, isn't it?
Oh, bless him. There you are, Simon Fowler. I told you we'd be good, right? Simon Fowler, Foxy Fowler on the podcast. And what a lovely, lovely chap. Now, you'll find more information, including links to order the book as well, on my website. Just check out the show notes for this podcast, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. And there's also a playlist of music that I've created featuring Simon on there too, with a few little surprises that you might not know about. So do check it out, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. And whilst you're there, you can show your support by heading into my store. You'll find our first official podcast mug, as well as sweatshirts for the winter, all of our exclusive merchandise in there, and you can buy a virtual coffee as well. And by doing that, you'll get a shout out on the podcast. So on the roll call this week, hello to Simon Fugsy Fergie, who says, "Great job, Dan. Keep on keeping on. Can't be much longer till you get the main man." You'd have thought, right? Peter Cook, hello to you. Alex McLaughlin says, "Keep on keeping on, Dan." Cheers, friend. Martin Alaric, hello to you, sir. Terry Vine, thank you for your support. Andy Tolcher. Lee O'Gorman says, "I look forward to every Tuesday. I've loved everyone. Thanks, Dan. All your dedication and research brings out the very best in all your guests. Keep the faith." Well, thank you, Lee. Much appreciated. Hello to Martin Morrow, who says, "Loving the podcast." Brian G, hello to you. Steve Cooper says, "Really enjoying the podcast. The research is very impressive and the guests have been brilliant." Thank you, Steve. Hello to Vincenzo Bicarino, who says, "Just listen to the Edgar Jones episode. I was not aware of him before the podcast, but decided to have a listen to some of his music. All I can say is it is amazing. Wish I discovered Loss earlier. Thanks for the introduction, Dan. I'll give it 5 stars. Well, thank you, Vincenzo. Much appreciated. And that's exactly what I love about this podcast, introducing us all to so many new things, new stories, new artists, new photographers, all of this stuff going on. Hello to Steve Perry. Thank you for your donation. Mike Steer. Cheers, pal. Thanks very much indeed. Kevin Smith, thanks for your virtual coffee as well. And thanks to all of you for your support as well. If you fancy doing it, head to my website,
grab a virtual coffee in the store and get a shout out next week. And now on the next episode of the podcast, an honorary counselor who was a huge part of the Star Council and also a key player in the early days of Paul Weller's solo career as well. Yes, Helen Turner is on the next episode of the podcast. Make sure you follow, you subscribe wherever you get yours, Apple, Spotify. You'll find me on social media as well. Do get in touch on Twitter at WellerFanPod or just search on Instagram and Facebook, Paul Weller Fan Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.